Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participant lines are in a listen-only mode. After today's presentation, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions, and at that time, you may press star, then one on your phone's keypad. Today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections to this, you may disconnect at this time. Now I will turn the call over to your host, Mr. Jamie Axford. Sir, you may begin.
Brad, thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone, and hello from Boston. Welcome to what I trust you'll find to be an insightful call. Certainly glad that you joined us this afternoon. Looking forward to our time together. We shouldn't be any more than 30 minutes this afternoon, but again, I think you'll find this call very insightful and give you some action steps that you can go back and put into your business going forward. The 10-year rates have backed up 100 basis points since early May. The Barclays U.S. aggregate is off 2.3% year-to-date. The average intermediate-term bond fund is off 2% year-to-date. Your sponsors and participants have most likely been affected. Everybody, good afternoon. My name is Jamie Axford with Putnam. I am joined here by Mike Wands, our Senior Investment Director for Fixed Income at Putnam. And welcome to our conference call, Rates Are Slowly Rising, Ideas That May Help with Tougher Investment Reviews Ahead. And we know that it is that time of the quarter that you're completing up your performance reviews and starting to meet with sponsors on a face-to-face basis regarding the performance over the last quarter and also over the long term. So we find this call to be very timely, and again, glad you are joining us this afternoon. In terms of the agenda, I'm going to really level set in the beginning on the current environment. Then I'm going to turn it over to Mike Wands, who is going to take a deeper dive into a different way to think about risk and ideas that will enable you to have fresh conversations with your plans. A couple housekeeping items up front. First of all of you should have received a copy of the PowerPoint around 10 o'clock Eastern time this morning. If you do not have the PowerPoint and would like it immediately, you can email Putnam_retirement_plans@Putnam.com. Again, that is Putnam_retirement_plans@Putnam.com. And again, this call is being recorded, so we'll make sure we send you out a link to the replay as well. So if you look at the fixed income marketplace right now, here's the problem, folks. The long-running bull market in bonds is waning, and we need to ask ourselves a couple questions. How should retirement plans invest in fixed income going forward? What is your strategy for dealing with rising rates and the eventual Fed tapering? The fixed income market is not the same as it was. It has certainly changed. The need for thought leadership and different options, in our opinion, has never been greater. And, folks, this is about going forward. That's what this call is all about. What are your sponsors and participants seeing? And that's where I'd like to turn your attention to slide two, which provides a few quotes from some newspapers around what sponsors and participants are, in fact, seeing, what they're hearing out there in the marketplace. As I mentioned, the last 3 months, 10-year is up 100 basis points. It actually closed today at 1071, so it's up about 110, 111 basis points over the last 3 months. So here's a few quotes that they're seeing out there that sponsors and participants are seeing in the marketplace. So Chicago Tribune, top fund managers were blindsided by U.S. bond market carnage. I've also heard the term earthquake thrown around a bit. The News Tribune, bond investors should heed rising interest rates. Bonds have been destroying savings in college funds, 401k funds, IRAs, and retirement nest eggs. And from the Dallas News, savvy investors should take note of slowly rising interest rates. If you turn to the next page, page three, this is really a visual on the impact of rising rates in just the last 3.5 years. And so some examples, if you look at the October 7, 2010 through December 15, 2010, we had 115 basis point increase in the 10-year bond, and the Barclays U.S. Ag over that time frame was down 300 basis points, or down 3.03%. Most recently, this June 14th through June 25th, the 10-year was up 46 basis points, and the Barclays Ag was off 2.23%. So funds that must, because of their size, hug the Barclays U.S. Ag are the most susceptible to large drawdowns, and that is really what we're trying to avoid. And especially here at Putnam, our concern as a firm that's heavily invested in the D.C. space and retirement readiness is that most plans and plan participants are exposed to interest rate risk, especially near and through retirement. So if you turn to the next page or the next slide, which is slide four, I want to introduce you to a recent study that was done by Casey Quirk titled When the Tide Turns, Building Next Generation Fixed Income Managers, and it's from this past May, so just a few months ago. And a few quotes from that article or from that report, which I think really hit the essence of what we're trying to say here this afternoon. The first quote, but the storm clouds are already here, and that, of course, is in the form of rising rates. Individual and defined contribution investors are most exposed. They hold $5 trillion in fixed income and are not prepared for losses in this part of their portfolio. U.S. investors facing uncertain bond markets will shift $1 trillion of assets from traditional fixed income products to next-generation debt strategies. Successful fixed income asset managers will be highly active and benchmark agnostic, offer broad capabilities, provide modern risk management, and rely on integrated sector teams. And finally, establish a thought leadership position around next-generation debt management. And that is really what Putnam is all about. We consider ourselves a next-generation debt manager, and that is really what we want to provide to you today. So lastly, demand in the D.C. space has increased dramatically for benchmark-aware and non-traditional options, so not benchmark-hugging, but benchmark-aware and non-traditional fixed income options. We are out in front of it. We are very passionate about it, and we are eager to support your efforts in this endeavor. So with that as a starting point, what I'd like to do is on slide five, turn it over to Mike Wands, again, Senior Investment Director of our Fixed Income Group, really to take a deeper dive on the current market state, take a different viewpoint into risk. And again, I mentioned that we view Putnam ourselves as a next-generation fixed income manager, so talk about our viewpoint and ideas to help you change the conversation around fixed income. So, Mike, with that, welcome, and thank you for being here. It's all yours.
Thanks, Jamie, and thank you, everybody, for dialing in today. We'll continue kind of through the presentation, and I'll try to cover a couple things relatively briefly and then hopefully leave some time at the end for questions. Hopefully people will dial in with questions. So, you know, Jamie talked about the risk of rising rates and the fact that rates are going up and the media attention around that, and, you know, you've all seen the various headlines. I think what that's done is scared a lot of people into thinking that maybe fixed income doesn't make sense in this environment and until we establish some sort of equilibrium in rates, and that could be well out into the future. I think there's two points that we'd like everybody to come away from today. One is that we do still think there are great opportunities in fixed income. And more importantly, there are ways that people can make money in fixed income, even in a rising interest rate environment, and we'll get into that in a bit. But the problem is, the issue is, you really need to be thinking about investing in fixed income differently than you had before. And then I guess the other point is, when people talk about bonds and rising rates, the impact there is really primarily going to be felt in the Treasury market or other types of government-related securities that the Fed has been buying. And we would suggest that once you move away from Treasuries into other types of spread product, whether that be corporate credit or mortgage credit or emerging market debt or things like that, that spread product, as we call it, in other words, non-Treasury securities, does still look attractive on a relative basis relative to a long-term average. And we think strategies that focus on that, either in a standalone basis or include that in their opportunity set, do still look attractive. So Jamie mentioned that this is all about looking forward, but if you flip to the next slide, slide six, before we look forward, let's take a quick look back over the last 20 or 30 years. And as Jamie mentioned, it was the perfect storm in a positive sort of way for the last 20 or 30 years for folks to make money in fixed income because, by and large, you saw interest rates generally falling over time from the high single digits to the low single digits where we are today. Certainly were periods of time in the interim like 93, 94, 98, 99 where rates rose as the Fed hiked rates in reaction to a growing economy and potential inflation scares. But in general, you had the wind at your back. And not only did you earn the coupon, you can see this is a graph of the 10-year Treasury over this time versus inflation where the average yield on the 10-year over this time was 5.4% roughly. But your return was greater than that. It was 100 basis points higher because you also had the benefit of rates falling, thus prices raising, and a nice positive return. It was a great reason to hold fixed income in a broader asset allocation mix. It provided a boost when equities might be falling, but also provided generally positive returns over this time frame, beating inflation. So the problem that we're in today is that rates, as you know, are significantly lower, and the wind is no longer at your back. Most likely the wind is in your face, and we've seen the results of that over the last couple months when rates have backed up, as Jamie mentioned, about 100 basis points, and fixed income strategies in general have produced negative types of returns for the most part. If you flip to the next slide, slide 7, the question that we naturally get then is, well, where can we go from here? We've already seen rates back up 100 basis points. We would use two kind of quick and simple ways to think about this, and here I'll focus on the 10-year again, which tends to be kind of the bellwether rate that people focus on. As Jamie mentioned, it closed today at just north of 270. One of the ways that I would answer this question is, well, where were rates before the Fed stepped in and started these various purchase programs through quantitative easing? So you go back to April 2009, and you can see in blue there where the curve was in 2009. At the 10-year part of the curve, we were just north of 3%, I think somewhere around 310, 315, something like that. So, you know, another 40 or 50 basis points higher than today. The other old school rule of thumb for us bond geeks, kind of, you know, who took economics 101 in college, was if you take the rate of, the simple way to determine where the yield of the 10-year should shake out over time, take the rate of growth in the economy, so GDP, and add to it inflation, and that roughly gives you the yield on the 10-year, and maybe factor in some term premium for going out 10 years. So if we assume that the economy continues to grow in the high, you know, one-ish, let's say roughly 2%, and add on maybe 1.5% for inflation, again, that gets you back to, you know, more like 3.5%. And that's in the current market environment. So, you know, another 50 to 100 basis points higher from here is not out of the question just as the Fed starts to begin tapering, you know, in the economy if it continues to grow at this type of rate. So what does that mean for investors? If you flip to slide 8, Jamie talked about the aggregate index. The aggregate index is the general broad U.S. market benchmark for fixed income. And many large fixed income funds tend to use this as their underlying benchmark. And obviously, the larger you get, the more likely it is that you're going to be, you know, you're going to look like the broad bond market. Think of the Russell 2000, I guess, for fixed income securities. And if you look at this benchmark, if you look at the pie chart, you know, various sectors of the index, the biggest ones being treasuries, government securities, mortgage-backed securities, those are all the sectors of the market that the Fed has been buying through QE 1, 2, and 3. So that's roughly 75% of the index. Now, why are they doing that? They're trying to keep interest rates low to stimulate growth in the economy, to make it easier for homeowners to borrow, corporations to borrow, the Treasury itself to borrow, but that's pushing rates down. So what does that leave you with? If you look to the right, the yield on the aggregate index is just north of 2%, 235 roughly, and this benchmark, this broad, you know, representation of the bond market has a duration, or in other words, a measure of interest rate risk of over 5.5 years. So what does that mean? General simple rule of thumb, that duration being a measure of price sensitivity, if rates were to back up, all things being equal, another 100 basis points, you're going to lose roughly 5.5% price. Well, you only got less than 2.5% yield. That means you're in for another negative return type of environment in the next 100 basis point backup in rates. So obviously that has people concerned, and people are starting to figure out, how do I protect myself from that? To make matters worse, if you take a little bit more sophisticated approach to thinking about fixed income exposure, flip to the next slide, or next page, page 9, if you think in terms of the fixed income market or the fixed income portfolios, not in terms of capital, market value, weightings of these different sectors, but a more sophisticated risk-based approach, where we here at Putnam define risk, kind of broadly speaking, at a high level, as falling into 3 or 4 main categories. The first three being term structure risk, which certainly includes duration, but other measures of interest rate movements in the marketplace. Credit risk, which is different types of credit in the marketplace. That could be corporate credit, that could be mortgage credit, that could be sovereign credit. And then prepayment risk, which is typically expressed by mortgage-backed securities and the ability of the homeowner to refinance, but there are other sectors of the market that also have prepayment risk. And then lump in a fourth risk, which is difficult to measure, but certainly one that's out there and people are painfully reminded of, being liquidity risk. If you use a risk-based approach and a more sophisticated risk model, what you see is the market today is dominated by what we call term structure risk, interest rate risk, and you're really not getting compensated for credit risk or prepayment risk. So why is that a problem if you think about where rates are and where spreads are today? If you flip to the next page, page 10, you'll see what we've shown here is the top 10 held fixed income funds across the kind of the spectrum of where people have money invested. And if you look again at the two biggest sectors of the market, treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, which again are what the Fed is buying right now through quantitative easing, you'll notice that most of these funds, if not all of these funds, have their dominant exposure in these two large sectors of the market. So what does that mean? I mean, look at the largest fund, and it's probably no surprise who that is given the size. 74%, almost three-quarters of that fund, has treasury exposure and mortgage exposure. That means that by nature, the yield on that portfolio, the yield on that fund, is going to be relatively low because the yield in those two sectors is relatively low, and you're going to be taking on a lot of this duration risk, term structure risk, if you're not hedging it out. So that's dangerous if we continue along this path of potential rising rates going forward. So if you flip to the next page, page 11, we try to kind of put a proof statement around why we think expanding your horizon and starting to think about different spread sectors, some of which are in the index and some of which are outside, make a lot of sense in building portfolios. And what this chart shows is for these various sectors, again, a handful that are in the aggregate index and then others that are outside, where on average did these sectors trade on a spread basis relative to treasuries for the 10 years prior to the crisis, and then where are they trading today? And today being the end of June, we just got July month-end data yesterday. We haven't updated this chart. We don't have all the information yet. But what we're trying to show is kind of where these sectors are trading relative to their long-term average. And again, if you look at sectors like agency debt and agency mortgage-backed securities, again, what the Fed has been buying, they're trading essentially right on top of their long-term averages. Whereas once you move into things like within the index, again, investment-grade corporates or commercial mortgage-backed securities, you know, decent yield pickup to relative or spread pickup relative to where they've traded historically. More importantly, once you start to move outside the benchmark and start to think outside the benchmark, as we've represented in some of these sectors below, you know, there's significant pickup in terms of spread, in terms of where you can find value in fixed income. Things like high yield, non-agency mortgage-backed securities, a subsector of the mortgage market called agency IOs, where you're making a real concentrated bet on that prepayment risk that I talked about, or emerging market debt. As you can see, all trading at significantly wider spreads to some of these benchmark-oriented sectors, and in many cases, significantly wider spreads to where they've traded historically. Now, in the case of high yield, you might point out, looking at the slide, well, high yield's actually trading through its long-term average, and that's true. The numbers do bear that out. We would argue that if you think about high yield, where the market is today relative to kind of a long-term perspective, we think high yield at this kind of spread looks really attractive, and we'll talk about that in a moment in terms of how you can take advantage of that. And a couple quick reasons around that without diving too much into the high-yield market. Defaults right now are running very, very low relative to historical averages, somewhere around 1%, whereas the long-term average is around 4%, which means you're going to earn a lot of the spread because a lot of the companies that you own in the high-yield market are not going to default, declare bankruptcy, and you don't have to worry about that. So you're earning a lot of this 500 basis points. The other thing, if you think about the market that we just went through over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of the poor credits in the high yield index defaulted in 2008, 2009 and fell out. So what you're left with is a cohort that's much stronger right now. So how do people take advantage of this, and what have various plans done as a way to react to, you know, potential rising rates and how that impacts their plans, and how do we avoid maybe you know, some of the pitfalls? And there's a couple steps that people have taken, and we've outlined those here. The first thing that people have done is think, well, let's move outside the U.S. and open up our opportunity set to a global bond strategy, which does make sense on the surface. The problem that I would point to that one needs to consider is if you're moving to a global bond strategy and the benchmark in that case is the global aggregate index, which is very similar in nature, it's actually the same problem, if not worse, because the yield on the global ag is lower than the U.S. ag, and you have more duration risk. So you have that same concentrated risk issue where term structure risk and currency now are going to be your biggest drivers of performance and volatility. So a good initial step, but maybe doesn't necessarily solve the problem. The other thing that people have done is introduced products in their plans or options in their plans to take advantage of some of these sector-specific opportunities that are out there. I mentioned high yield. You know, others that people have done is looked at bank loans. That's been a really popular strategy so far this year. A lot of money has flowed into bank loan funds or emerging market debt that I talked about. So offering sector-specific strategies where people can kind of make that asset allocation decision themselves, of course, that leaves the asset allocation decision to the participant themselves to make. The other thing to do is to take that asset allocation decision out of the participant's hands and put it in the bond manager's hands by looking at an ag-based fund where the bond manager has a latitude to go into some of these non-index opportunities, to invest in high yield or bank loans or EM or some of these other sectors that I mentioned. And we definitely think that makes sense. If you're going to stick to a benchmark-oriented fund with the ag as your benchmark, allow the manager to kind of move away from the underlying benchmark and have some latitude to take advantage of some of these other opportunities. The last option that I'll mention, and I think this is really kind of thinking outside the box and moving, into the wave of the future, and where we spend a lot of our time, I think, talking to consultants and institutional plans, is a multi-sector fixed income approach where you've removed the benchmark altogether and basically have the option to invest in all these asset classes that the manager does, but you're not tying their performance or not tying their fund to the underlying benchmark. And those would fall in the category of absolute return funds or strategic income funds. There's a whole bunch of different products out there like that, and we'll talk about one of ours in a second. I admit that it's definitely more of a forward-thinking type, wave of the future type product. We think it makes a lot of sense, but it's definitely a complicated sale. And I would also caution you that all those funds are not the same. In fact, many of them are very different. So if you are looking at these types of products and potentially adding them to plans or recommend they be added to plans, make sure you do your homework around those. So lastly, I'm gonna finish on this slide before I turn it back to Jamie to wrap up. If you flip to slide 13, this is a little bit of a complicated slide, so I'll walk through this in a second. What we're trying to show here is the two broad benchmarks, again, the U.S. Ag and the Global Ag, and then compare them to a couple of different funds in our fund lineup, the Income Fund, which is our ag-based fund, Global Income Trust, the Global Ag Fund, and then the Absolute Return 300 Fund, which, again, is this more of this kind of product of the current and of the future, where we're not necessarily tethered to a benchmark in any case. And what this chart is trying to show you on the top dark blue line is the amount of volatility measured in ex-ante tracking error, ex-ante risk, in the benchmark itself, so 3-ish and close to 5% in the ag and global ag, and then in the various funds that we offer. And then below that, those three broad risk categories that I talked about, term structure risk, credit risk, broken up into different categories, and prepayment risk, and where the percentage of the risk allocated in those benchmarks and in these funds is allocated. And again, to point to the U.S. Ag, and it's a glaring example right now. If you look at the end of June, in a more sophisticated risk model like ours and others that exist in the marketplace, more than 100% of the risk in that benchmark is term structure risk. In other words, all of your performance and all of your volatility is going to come from movements in interest rates. If anything, the little amount of credit exposure you have or prepayment exposure that you have is it's really not going to move the dial out that much, and in some cases, maybe even be a kind of an offsetting risk in the portfolio. If you look at the income fund, for example, though, our benchmark-oriented strategy where we're trying to produce a return in excess of the aggregate index, still have 60-ish percent of our risk in that portfolio relative to the term structure risk because, again, we're trying to run versus a broad benchmark. But 40% of the risk in the fund is in these other sectors of the market, corporate credit, mortgage credit, prepayment risk, where we think there's a lot of value and we're taking advantage of wider spreads. If you move all the way over to the right, the Absolute Return 300 Fund, where we're targeting a return of 300 basis points over cash over a cycle with a volatility of roughly 3%, which you can see by comparison is pretty close to the broad benchmark itself, at least in an overall risk basis, you'll notice that very little, if any, risk is in term structure or currency space, but the majority, if not all, of our risk budget is allocated to those sectors of the market that we deem as still being very attractive, corporate credit, mortgage credit, to a lesser degree, emerging market debt, and then prepayment risk. And I think with that, I'll turn it back over to Jamie to try to keep us on a relatively tight schedule here. Let him wrap up and then hopefully open up to some questions.
Mike, thank you very much. I just want to finish up with a few things, folks, and then again, we will open it up for some Q&A. If you turn to the next slide, which is slide 14, titled Morningstar Mutual Fund Rankings, I really wanted to finish this segment by looking at Putnam from an enterprise level and point to the fact that not only are we a next-generation fixed income manager and a very innovative fixed income manager from a product set, we are also a company with very strong overall enterprise performance. And if you look on the top right corner of the percentage of funds category, you'll see 1, 3, 5, and 10 years across the top, and you will see top decile, quartile, above median, and bottom quartile along the left side. And if you look at our record from the short term to the long term, you'll find it to be very strong across our fund family, If you look at 1 year above median, 91%, 86% above median for 3 years, 76% for 5 years, and 63% for 10 years. So to me and to everyone here, this really speaks to the horsepower of the engine we have at Putnam, the people, the investment process, and more importantly, in my opinion, the sustainability of it. And then finally, I just want to wrap up on the last page with a few points and also next steps for everyone on the call. We hope you agree that a less benchmark-hugging fund and its benefits is the right direction for your conversations going forward and also for your plan lineups. I think it's important for all of us to remember why you purchase fixed income or include fixed income in a lineup in the first place. And this hasn't changed. You buy it for income. You buy it as a diversifying asset class. You buy it to lower overall portfolio volatility. You need a different approach to get that now. So as we referred to earlier with the bond market, with the bond bull market waning, the eventual end to Fed buying, heavily concentration of risk in the benchmark in the Barclays U.S. Ag, the rules have really changed when it comes to fixed income, and we all need to address that. So in terms of next steps, what I would ask all of you to do, all of you on the call to do, is first of all to look at the funds that you use in your fixed income lineups and ask yourself a few questions. Number one is, how much yield am I getting? So how much yield am I getting? If it's not enough, then that's not good. Number two, what is the duration of the fund that I'm using? If that's too high, that's not a good thing in this environment, as we've talked about it and Mike dug deeper on before. Number three, what is the exposure to treasuries, agency MBS, so mortgages, and agency debt? If it's too high, it's not necessarily good in this environment. But fourth, the final question is ultimately, how has the fund performed when rates have risen? If your fund of choice is minus 2% year to date, I submit to you it's possibly hugging the aggregate and it's heavily exposed to interest rate risk. So let's change the conversation. Through our offerings, we can certainly support your efforts in doing that. So with that, Brad, I'd like to turn it back to you to open up for some Q&A.
Certainly. If you have a question at this time, please press star then one on your phone keypad. If at any time your question has been answered, you may remove your request by pressing star two. Once again, please press star one if you have a question at this time. Please stand by for questions, sir. Once again, please press star then one if you have a question at this time. Please stand by, sir.
Brad, one question, if you can hear me.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. One question I'd like to pose to Mike is, you know, we talked about the income fund. We talked about our absolute return 300 fund, so our unconstrained portfolio. Do you view those as a complement or a replacement to funds that are widely used in the DC space?
So I think in both cases a great complement to what somebody probably already has in their lineup. The income fund is an ag-based fund, and many plans, obviously, if not all plans, are going to have a similar product. But my guess is the way that we run the income fund and the way we think about risk is going to be different than what they have, so it would certainly be a good complement for some of these other big, well-known funds out there. Absolute Return 300 is obviously a very different type of product. It doesn't have an underlying benchmark. It's a, from a risk standpoint, a similar type of fund in terms of shooting for about 3% volatility relative to, say, stocks with 15% volatility, but no underlying benchmark. So we think this fund, you know, should do well regardless of the direction of rates and certainly if rates move up. But I think to take the leap to move completely away from the ag into this type of product is pretty difficult, and certainly given our conversations, we recognize that. So I think it provides a great complement. It, you know, if you already have a fund in your plan that you expect to underperform in a rising interest rate environment, I think it makes sense to consider putting one in that would do well in that type of environment. So a good complement.
Great. Brad, let me turn it back to you for questions.
Certainly. We do have a response from Mark Forkey. Your line is open, sir.
Hey, Jamie and Mike. Question similar, I think, to your last question to Mike. I think it, as a complement, would be nice, and we could obviously add some funds that will perform better in a rising interest rate market. But my question is really, are you going to have discussions with clients about replacing? Because I think that's the only way we can affect change. Participants are going to be slow, and they probably aren't going to totally understand how to allocate correctly if we just add a couple new funds. Do you envision having conversations with plan sponsors about, you know, replacing either a benchmark hugging fund or an actual index fund with some of these strategies?
Mark, thanks for the question, first of all. I think that, you know, to Mike's response a little while ago, I think that the conversation is more around a complement. You know, Mike referred to the fact that, you know, you don't necessarily want to get away from the intermediate term ag type of fund or the ag hugging fund, but I think there's definitely, and I think right now is definitely the opportune time to start looking at that complement. And I think the Putnam Income Fund, the Putnam Absolute Return 300 Fund are those funds because, again, they're going to take advantage of opportunities outside the ag, and they're going to be able to take advantage of opportunities in a rising rate environment. And so you look at the Absolute Return 300 Fund year to date, it's up about 2.5% around that range. So, again, you know, being unconstrained, it has the ability to take advantage of areas that a Barclays Ag Hugging Fund is not able to.
Great. Thanks, Jerry. I guess my concern would be just getting participants to take action. You know, as we know, they've been slow just to get back in equities, and by the time they figure out rates are rising, it could be another 1 or 2 years, and so I'm just interested in that approach. Thanks.
The problem is if rates continue to rise for the next year or two, you know, they're going to continue to experience this negative performance. So that's why I think it's great to have that option there for people in the, you know, in the interim.
Brad, any more questions?
We've had no further responses at this time, sir.
Okay. Another question I'd like to throw out to Mike is, you know, a lot of consultants, advisors are building custom target date funds, custom models. How do you see something like the income or the absolute return 300 fitting into that type of strategy?
You know, again, I think it's a nice option to have. I mean, at the end of the day, the goal, we showed that chart of rates versus inflation. The end of the goal is to beat inflation. And if you're in an ag-based product where your yield is, you know, slightly less than 2.5%, if inflation starts to pick up and rates go higher, you're not going to beat inflation. You're going to lag inflation. The goal of a absolute return style strategy is to beat cash. Cash is a surrogate for inflation, right? If short-term rates go up, it's a reflection of inflation going up. I think, personally, this type of strategy makes a lot of sense. You know, I'm not saying that as a product person. I'm saying that as an individual investor who has money in a 401k plan and an investment vehicle.
Great. I appreciate that. And Mark, back to your earlier question, I think that, you know, obviously it really is all about education. I think the funds, you know, even if you're talking about Absolute Return 300 Fund as a standalone, maybe somewhat confusing, if you will, for a participant, but when you talk about the fixed income part of the portfolio in aggregate and how, again, one is more of a core, another one is a complement to that to protect you, you know, certainly in a rising rate environment, I think that argument makes a lot of sense and it has a lot of legs. Brad, any questions?
We've had no further responses, sir.
All right. Well, again, everyone, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. We are in this together as thought leaders. And again, I hope you will look to us as support in your endeavors and in your conversations with sponsors and participants. Please reach out to us if you do have any further questions. And as always, we appreciate your consideration and time this afternoon. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for your participation on today's conference call. At this time, all parties may disconnect.